yesterday we talked about how, you know, even though we've decomposed the Einstein equations into evolution equations and constraint equations, you know, there's still, you still have a considerable amount of freedom. For example, yesterday we talked about how for the evolution equations, because of the, you know, the gauge degrees of freedom or choice of coordinates in the Einstein equations, and also the fact that we have constraints, you can sort of manipulate the evolution equations, and some choices of the evolution equations are turn out to not be well posed, but you can find formulations that are well posed. And so we gave the example of the generalized harmonic formulation yesterday. I think in one of the tutorials soon you work out another example called the BSSN formulation. But today we're going to go back to the initial data problem and talk about how to solve the constraint equations. So we can start with you know, data on our t equals zero slice that solves the constraint part of the equations. And so, yeah, so we're going to talk about the initial data problem, GR. And if you're interested in more details, again, you can see the Gourgagnon notes. In particular, chapter 8 goes through a lot of the details. And I'll write down the archive number again. So today we sort of have two goals when we're trying to construct initial data, and they're sort of somewhat in tension. So the first goal is we want to choose some spatial metric gamma ij, some extrinsic curvature kij, such that we satisfy the constraint equations. So I'll write those down again. So that's the Hamiltonian constraint. And this is the momentum constraint. And this is the, you know, the energy density. Again, we get by projecting a stress energy tensor with two unit normals. And this is the momentum density. So, you know, one, we want to solve the constraints, because if we're not solving the constraints, then we're not solving the Einstein equations. But you know, we don't want to just choose any arbitrary values for these. We want that to represent the physical system we're interested in as closely as possible. So if our system we're interested in is two black holes that, you know, have been orbiting each other for a long time in a quasi-circular motion, and one black hole has, you know, this masses and spins, the other has that, then we want to choose initial data that approximates that as well as we can.
So we're just looking at the spiral phase
now? That's just one example. We're sort of, yeah, completely general. Yeah, it could be.
You're looking at the whole phase, not just like the because you mentioned that quasi circular. I thought maybe we just like in the beginning before merger, and just looking at that.
That could be an example of initial conditions. So we were interested in, you know, two black holes far away, and they're going to end spiral close to each other. Could be something else completely. You know, some gravitational wave propagating, or you know, star going supernova or whatever we're interested in. So the sort of strategy we're going to use is we're going to divide our degrees of freedom sort of into two groups. So degrees of freedom into two groups. And we'll call those the free data. So those are the functions that we freely specify to get our physical system. And then the second one is the constrained data. And these are the functions that we will we'll basically solve for to make sure that we satisfy the Hamiltonian momentum constraint. So sort of the two goals here then are to choose this free data so that we have some physical intuition about what it means or how to choose it for a system. But then also we want to make sure that when we write down the equations for our constrained data that they have nice mathematical properties. You know, they form nice elliptic equations. We have things like uniqueness and existence of solutions. Yeah.
Last session we were talking about the constrained ones, like the constraints that we had. It was something related to fixing the gauge. Is it always like that? Like always the constraint in GR is somehow related to gauge fixing?
So last time we talked about this constraint we introduced for the generalized harmonic, which is basically we were requiring the box of the coordinates to be equal to something, right? That's sort of the coordinate degrees of freedom, and you can choose those freely. These are, in some sense, physical constraints on our t equals zero slice. They're equations that you have to satisfy. So we showed, for example, for the generalized harmonic, that you can choose whatever source functions you want, but solving the momentum and Hamiltonian constraint basically ensures that the time derivative of your constraints is zero, so that if you evolve forward with something that satisfies that constraint, and you satisfy Hamilton momentum constraints, then this gauge fixing will be true for all time. So it's a little bit different, I'd say. So for example, this one is basically the equation that would reduce to like the Poisson equation in Newtonian physics, right? So it's not just coordinate. Yeah, so for example, an example of sort of a bad way to do this would be to say, okay, I'm gonna choose like gamma xx, and then I'm gonna solve for gamma yy. Because you sort of would want to control both those to set up your physical degree of freedom. So the sort of strategy that's common in studying initial data and that we're going to follow here is to instead do a conformal decomposition of these quantities. And we'll see that this actually gives us some nice elliptic equations when you write out the constraint equations. And in some sense, if we choose our conformal variables sufficiently well, then this overall conformal rescaling will be small or close to one in some sense. So since we're going to do, before I get into the conformal rescaling, let's just count the number of degrees of freedom we have. So how many constraint equations do we have?
Four.
Yeah, we have four. We have the Hamiltonian constraint, and then the momentum constraint has three different components. And then how many degrees of freedom are we solving for by trying to choose gamma ij and kij?
Sorry, I'm not a big fan of bit confused. What are we having for constrained equation one more time again?
Just because we're sort of counting scalar degrees of freedom, so this one counts as three because you have three components. Yep. Yeah, so by trying to choose gamma ij and kij, how many degrees of freedom is that? I heard.
I think it's 12, right?
12, yeah. So we have, you know, generally they'll be 3 by 3, but they're symmetric, so there's only 6 free components, and then we have 2 of them. So 6 plus 6 is 12. Yeah, so that means that we need to specify 8 degrees of freedom. And that's in addition to any matter fields we have. OK, so we're going to do that using that conformal decomposition. So I'm going to write down a couple sort of helpful formulas for you know, basically relating quantities defined with respect to some metric, and then it's conformal rescaling. So first, I'll just write down the sort of general n-dimensional case. So say we have some n-dimensional metric GAB, and then we do a conformal rescaling with omega squared. And then the conformal quantities I'll indicate with a tilde. So if you sort of plug this into the you know, equations for defining the covariant derivatives and the Riemann tensor and so on, you can work out relations between these. I'm just going to write down those formula. If you want to see the details, I think, for example, you can see they're given in the appendix of Carroll, if you have that textbook. Or they're not, you know, terribly difficult to work out yourself, they're just a bit tedious. All right, so the first one is just the scalar derivative. So that doesn't really change since the covariant derivative acting on a scalar is just the ordinary partial derivative. We'll use, for just acting on a scalar, we'll use the, sorry. We'll use the ordinary covariant derivative and the conformal one interchangeably. But then if we act on a vector, these will be different. Let's see if all those indices make sense. I think that's OK. And in general, it'll be helpful to write down the difference between the Christoffel symbols for, you know, those calculated with our ordinary metric and then our conformally rescaled metric. Call that CAB. this is just the definition, and then the formula is given by the following. So we can kind of read it off from here. Okay. And then finally, we'll need one more formula, and that'll be the Ricci curvature. Okay. And so far I've written these down in sort of general and dimensional form, but very from here on out we're going to restrict to the case of n equals 3. So basically doing the conformal decomposition of our first spatial metric into a conformal factor and a conformal metric.
The GR is not conformally symmetric, right? As far as I can recall, I'm here.
Right. Yeah. So you get all these extra terms. So you're saying,
that's why we are going to limit ourselves only to n equal to 3.
We're going to n equals 3 because we're interested in, finding equations. We're basically interested in solving for the spatial metric, so we can solve the constraint equations. And we want to divide basically the spatial metric and the extrinsic curvature into some free data and some constrained data. So it's going to turn out that we're going to choose the conformal spatial metric as our free data, and then the conformal factor as our constrained data.
So in three dimensions, then the GR equations are conformally symmetric. It doesn't matter here.
Yeah, so we're still starting with four-dimensional Einstein equations. We're not changing that. But once we project our four-dimensional Einstein equations, we get Hamilton momentum constraint, and in our 3+1 decomposition, those are in terms of three-dimensional quantities. So now we're interested in decomposing those. But we're still considering space-time to have four dimensions. Yeah.
Can I ask something?
Yep.
The last Ricci equation there, is it the definition for R tilde, or do we define R tilde from somewhere else?
Yeah, so R tilde would be just take this metric here, okay. and then use the usual formula, but everything defined in terms of tilde quantities. Yeah. Any other questions? Yeah. All right, so now we're going to look at one particular formulation of the initial data problem called the conformal transverse traceless decomposition. And as we go through, we'll sort of build up all these adjectives in our decomposition. So first, as we've already alluded to, we're going to perform a conformal rescaling of our spatial metric And actually, we're going to use the instead of using this omega squared, I'm actually going to use a psi to the fourth. And it'll become obvious why sort of this power is more convenient than that one. But obviously, you can relate the two. You know, omega would just be psi squared. Yeah, and so it's going to turn out that we're going to choose this to be our constrained data. And this is going to be our free data. So basically, we're going to work out what the Hamiltonian constraint is as an equation where you solve for psi. All right, so we need to decompose the Hamiltonian constraint. So we're going to start with the first term, which is the 3 Ricci scalar. And then we're going to use this formula with n equals 3. Yeah, what's the question?
I don't get why you say we're choosing this to be the constrained data and that to be free data. I thought, like, this is how our equation tells us. Like, you know, we have some equations, and the ones that they're having, like, time derivatives, their evolution equations, and the ones that don't have it, that would give us the constraint. That's why it's like the equations themselves tell us which one is which.
Right. So the equations tell us we need to specify 12 things, and we have 4 constraints, right? So then we have some freedom about how to choose the rest, and we have some freedom about which of those 12 degrees of freedom we want to choose ourselves, and which we want to basically, which ones we want to choose freely, and which ones we want to basically take to be the values that satisfy the constraint equations. So these 8 degrees of freedom that we worked out, those which of the 12 we choose for that, we have some freedom regarding that. If that makes sense, right?
Okay.
Yep.
Would you please repeat the motivation that we are doing this conformal rescaling? Why was that? In the beginning, you mentioned that.
Yeah, it just
independently.
Well, it's sort of there'll be two motivations. One is sort of mathematical, in the sense that it'll turn out that our Hamiltonian constraint will become some nice Laplace-looking form for this conformal factor. And the other one is sort of physical, in the sense that, for example, you know, let's say I have you know, 2 black holes that are far away. So one simple thing might, one simple way to specify initial data for them might be to basically just superpose those 2 black hole solutions, you know, add them together, subtract flat space. That's not going to be an exact solution to the constraint equations because GR is a nonlinear theory, but I could take that to be my free data, and then I could solve for this conformal factor. And if they're reasonably far away, then I would expect this conformal factor to be reasonably close to 1. So in some sense, just you can choose this to be as close, you can choose this to be close to what you think the physical answer should be. Or another choice would be to choose this to just be the flat metric and then just solve for some correction. But it's sort of, it's easier to find a physically motivated way for choosing this as opposed to, I don't know, just choosing one component of it and then letting the other one be completely free or something.
I see. Thank you. So in the beginning, just the normal formalism is what the gammas, they were our constraint data, actually, right? And then we are, with this transformation, instead of choosing gammas, we are saying gammas are free. My constraints are going into, everything is going into the size, right?
Yeah, so we're not done sort of going through this whole decomposition. So when we're done, we'll have to have sort of 8 free data functions, and then we'll have, you know, we'll have 4 constrained functions. So far, we have 1 constrained one, and then the components of that are the free data one.
Yeah, here, right. But what I mean, if you don't go through the conformal decomposition or rescaling, in the beginning, our constraint data was through the two set of equations of the constraint equations. And over there,
So when we just write those down, we haven't yet specified how to choose the 4 and the 8. We just have these 12 quantities in the 4 equations. So we have to make some choice, and this will be one example of them. All right, so yeah, so let's work out the 3 Ricci scalar using that formula. And if we just plug through that, we get the following. So we could actually simplify this equation. So if you notice this term here, when you multiply that, actually cancels out with this term here. So we can cancel the two out. And that sort of explains this mysterious choice of 4 here, because that puts it in this nice form. So then we're really just left with this term and then this term. So that's sort of one term in the Hamiltonian constraint. The next term involves the extrinsic curvature. So now we're going to talk about how we can decompose that. So you know, as hinted by this adjective here, we're going to do a decomposition into a trace part and a trace-free part for the extrinsic curvature. So by construction, this is trace-free. And we're going to further decompose this part, or we're going to further conformally rescale this part. And you know, here I've chosen this factor of psi to the 10, which will be a little bit mysterious for now. But again, we'll find that it simplifies our expressions greatly. So with these sort of new choices, ready to rewrite our Hamiltonian constraint.
Thank you.
So we're pretty much done with the Hamiltonian constraint. You can see that now it's actually just beginning to look like a, this is just Laplace operator with respect to our conformal metric acting on psi. And then we just have lower order terms here. And for example, here, this is this conformal Ricci scalar we can just calculate automatically if we taking the conformal metric to be free data. So let's turn to the momentum constraint now. So looking at the first term in the momentum constraint, we want to rewrite this term in terms of our new quantities here. Yeah, and in case I didn't say this, so again, we're going to choose the trace to be free data. And then if we want to do a conformal decomposition of this, these C's are the ones that I defined right here that basically are what you get for swapping out the Christoffel symbols with respect to the spatial metric and the ones with respect to the conformal spatial metric. So if we use that expression there, we get the following. Okay, and actually it's not quite as bad as this. So this term here is actually zero. Can anyone tell me why? It has to do with the definition of AJK. Yeah, it's trace free. Yeah, so this is zero. And actually we can simplify this one slightly, which is using this hat, a hat.
Can I ask something? Yep. On the line above that, what's the index of A, the last A?
Is that AKI?
Is it AKI?
Sorry, this.
Yeah.
Did I? A. Yes. Yeah, so then we can rewrite that in terms of this, or you can sort of combine these terms to get this, and then in terms of the a hat quantity I've defined. Just the following. All right, but we're still not quite done. We need to further decompose this guy. So we're basically going to decompose it into a longitudinal part and a transverse part. This is the longitudinal part. And this is the transverse part. So, by definition, I'm going to require this to, first of all, still have zero trace, but also by transverse, I mean if you take the divergence, you get zero. So I'm just going to assert that you can, in general, do this decomposition. This is basically kind of a generalization of like the Helmholtz theorem, where you take some vector field and you write it as a gradient of a scalar plus the curl of a vector potential. And I have to still define what this quantity is. So here, xi is our vector potential. And that's what we're going to solve for. And then this L tilde is the conformal Killing operator.
Where does that D come from when you were trying to show that that's traceless?
This is the traceless property, that this is zero, and that this is zero is the transverse property. So that's why it gets two t's, because it's transverse and traceless. So this is defined the following way. So you can see this would be similar to de Killing's equation if I didn't have this, but then I've added this part to make sure that it's also trace-free. So both these quantities are trace-free, and that makes sense because they add together to be something that's also trace-free. All right, so we're getting close now. Now we're ready to define the conformal vector Laplacian of our vector xi, which is going to be our constrained data, our constrained data. So we represent that with delta L. And that's going to basically just take the covariant derivative of this conformal Killing operator. And by this construction here, so if I take the conformal covariant derivative of this, then this one will be zero, and then this one will just be this term right here. So this should equal this. just by this transverse property. All right, so now we're basically ready to write down our two equations. So I'm going to rewrite the Hamiltonian constraint and then also put this all together to rewrite the momentum constraint. And the one thing we haven't talked about yet is whether we need to conformally rescale these matter sources, the energy density and the momentum density. So this is the conformal transverse traceless Hamiltonian constraint. So here I'm going to leave it for like a general conformal transformation of the energy density, and same for the momentum, and then we'll talk about what's the right way to choose those powers. So that's the Hamiltonian constraint, and now the momentum constraint in this form. So we, in both cases, we have something like a you know, Laplace type equation, both for this scalar psi and a vector-like Laplace equation for this x vector potential. And so those are going to be our constrained data. And then all the other quantities are the free data. But yeah, so the last thing to talk about is what's the right way to rescale the matter. So I wrote this in general where the energy density goes like psi to the n, and the momentum density conformal one is related to the unrescaled one, like psi to the m. And then we can sort of look at the equations and choose a nice form for them. So first, discussing this one, we can, if we look at the momentum constraint, we can see that if we make a choice of initial data, so this k, the trace of the extrinsic curvature, is free data. So if we choose that to be constant, then we'll only have one term that depends on the conformal factor. And if we further choose m to be 10, then this term will also not depend on the conformal factor. So that's a reason one usually makes the choice m equals 10. And this this choice of constant extrinsic curvature on your, at least on your initial momentum slice, is called constant mean curvature. So, m equals 10, momentum constraint is independent of psi if k is constant. That's called constant mean curvature, or CMC. Yeah. Yeah, this is the conformal vector Laplacian, which I've defined here.
When you're looking at conformal transformations, I always thought that you're scaling your dependent with same factor. But here, you're changing matter in one, and then you're changing the geometry in another. And also, you're not changing the matter in all of them the same way. You're changing the energy in with one factor and changing the momentum with the other one.
Right.
Shouldn't conformal is not about just the
rescaling
everything?
So what we're really doing is saying, instead of choosing E as our free data, let's choose E tilde as our free data. So you shouldn't really think of it as there's some physical quantities that we know ahead of time and we're just like changing coordinates. That's not how we should really think about it. The way we're thinking about it is, we're choosing some quantities and then we're solving some other quantities, and only once we have everything together do we know what the physical quantities are, right? So in that sense, it's not really clear that it makes more sense to say that the energy density is this as opposed to the conformal energy density is that before you actually know what the metric of the on that slice is, right?
Yeah.
Two questions actually. K tilde and K are the same?
I don't think I wrote K tilde anywhere, right? But
yeah, I mean in that Hamiltonian constraint over there.
Yeah.
We consider the conformal transformation for everything except the K. Everything still is K.
Yeah, I'm choosing like the K is my free data, not choosing some K tilde is my free data. Yeah.
And why are we expecting that? Why should my energy and momentum get rescaled in this conformal transformation? I mean, physical variables, right? I was expecting that they are invariant under this transformation then.
Like we're just saying, like you really shouldn't think of it as we have some physical quantities and we're just making a coordinate transformation. That's not what we're doing. We're choosing some free data and then we're solving some for some other data. And then only after we have both those do we know what the physical quantities are. You could choose the fix the energy density, but then the physical metric, like the spatial metric is not specified. So you're kind of choosing energy density before you know what the metric is. So that's going to change anyway, right? So in that sense, it's not really clear that it's more physical to choose this at the beginning than that. I mean, if we are in a situation where, our conformal quantities are close to the ones we get out, we solve for psi and it's close to one, then it'll be similar. But a priori, we don't know the full geometry even on our slice, right? Yeah, and so, that brings us to our next point, which is what we should choose for this n here, how we should rescale our energy density. That the sort of scaling for that is going to come from considering uniqueness considerations. In particular, the thing we're worried about is that we have sort of two nearby solutions, so this local uniqueness. So we want to rule out the possibility that we have two nearby solutions that both satisfy this equation. So to sort of figure out the best way to choose this n so that that doesn't happen, let's say we have some solution psi and then some other solution psi bar, and they're related by some function epsilon, and we're going to take epsilon to be very small compared to psi, and then we're going to take our Hamiltonian constraint and just expand it and only keep the linear order terms in epsilon. So if we do that, then we get the following. This whole thing is times epsilon, and I'll just call this whole constant here C. So from your PDE's class, you might remember this idea of the maximum principle. So basically, if we apply the maximum principle to this equation here, then it says that if this quantity is greater than or equal to zero, then we can argue that both epsilon and minus epsilon will take their maximum on the boundary. So if we choose some boundary condition such that epsilon is zero, then it'll have to actually be zero throughout the domain. So that follows by the maximum principle. And yeah, of course, we should keep in mind when we're solving these elliptic type equations, we always have to have boundary conditions where we, you know, have some either sort of spatial infinity or in some finite region, we specify what the boundary conditions would be on our elliptic variables. So the point is we want this whole quantity to be positive. These ones we have some sort of control over. But this one, you know, we want the energy density to always be positive, right? And we don't want this to make a negative contribution to there. In particular, if these quantities are for zero, and this quantity were, if we were had n less than five, then we wouldn't be able to satisfy the maximum principle, and we wouldn't be guaranteed local uniqueness. So for that reason, we want to choose n greater than or equal to 5. So we have some choice there. In different cases, it might be convenient to take different choices for this n. But there's one particularly common one, and that's n equals 8. And that's actually motivated by wanting to satisfy the dominant energy condition. So if you recall, the dominant energy condition says the following. If I take my stress energy tensor and if I decompose it this way, basically this quantity should be less than or equal to zero for any future pointing causal vector Na. So if I write this in terms of energy and momentum density, I get this. And, you know, or said it another way, so you can kind of think of it as, you know, some condition that your matter isn't sort of superluminal in terms of its momentum not being too big compared to its energy density. So the point is, with this choice of conformal rescaling, if our conformal quantities satisfy this, then our conformal rescale quantities will satisfy that. So we can just see that by working this out. Let's so if we are requiring that, so let's say we're assuming that our conformal quantities satisfy the dominant energy condition, then we have this. And then basically we can absorb you know, a factor of 4 into here, and then using this m equals 10, we'll have, so if we have a factor of psi to the 4 to make this the ordinary spatial metric, then this will be psi to the minus 20, and then we can put a psi minus 10 on each of these and get the quantities that are not conformally rescaled. All right, so any questions about that? OK, so I think this is probably a good place to end. So tomorrow we'll give a couple of simple examples of solving this conformal transverse traceless equation, and talk about some of the general considerations one has when trying to solve the initial data problem in GR.